I'd like to talk to you on the subject, give, and it shall be given. We're familiar with Jesus' words, ask, and you shall receive, and that is sort of a beginner's lesson. Prayer is asking, and Jesus did say, ask and ye shall receive, but then there were other times when he makes it quite clear that we can't possibly receive everything we ask. He didn't. Paul didn't. Remember, Paul asked the Lord 3 times to take away that thorn or that sharp pain, and it was not taken away. Only the word was given to him, my grace is sufficient for you. And Jesus said, if you ask bread, you won't get a stone. He didn't go on to say what would happen if we asked for a stone. And I think the truth is that very often our prayers are stones. And God is not going to give us those prayers, those stones. We think it's bread. It's something that looks to us like bread, but God knows it's a stone, and it'll choke us. And so there's a deadlock, because he will not give us anything but bread, and we are insisting that we want stones. But then there's a much more advanced lesson in the spiritual life, more advanced than ask and it shall be given. And that is, give, and it shall be given. Pressed down, running over. And this follows along with what we were talking about this morning, the life of the cross, the sign of the cross in our lives. The message of the cross is self-giving love. It was there that Jesus Christ laid down his life, and he said, no man takes it from me. I lay it down of myself. He poured out his soul unto death, it says in Isaiah 53. Poured out his soul unto death. Lilias Trotter, in that beautiful little book, Parables of the Cross, has an exquisite painting. She was a very fine artist, trained under John Ruskin. Probably could have made quite a name for herself in Europe, but instead went to North Africa as a missionary. She was the founder of the Algiers Mission Band, which has now merged with the North Africa Mission. But in this little book, which is beautifully illustrated with her paintings of flowers and seeds, one of the most memorable to me is a dandelion seed sphere. This beautiful, delicate, feathery sphere of seeds. And she has inscribed around that sphere in a sort of a halo the words, I'm ready to be offered. And the dandelion holds up that beautiful little sphere of seeds. And they are so delicately attached that the tiniest wind can blow them away. Who of us as a child hasn't picked one of those and blown those seeds away? And the breath of God can blow us away if we are ready to be offered. But the beauty of all of those illustrations from nature is the serenity, the peacefulness with which each cycle goes into effect. I think of that when I think of aging. I think how little serenity most of us have at the idea of our rapidly multiplying birthdays. And there's something that really does happen when you pass the age of 50, I discovered. There's something suddenly accelerated about this aging process. I can look at women now anywhere from 25 to 45, and I'm so old now that I can't tell the difference. 40-year-old women look so terribly young to me, I could guess them to be 25. But I have a hunch that I can be pretty sure when I'm looking at a woman who's over 50. And I look in the mirror myself in the mornings, and I'm just aghast at the chaos and destruction, you know, that hymn, change and decay and all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. And I'm thinking about doing a little birthday booklet to go along with that series of booklets back there, because I do think that we have allowed the world around us to squeeze us into its own mold, and we make all these foolish jokes about birthdays and how they don't count anymore, and I'm 39 and holding, and we women are so really silly about not wanting to admit how old we are, as if we could possibly kid anybody. You know, who do we think we're kidding? We're not kidding anybody but ourselves if we don't tell anybody, because the chances are they're probably going to guess you to be 10 years older than you are, so you might as well tell them. However, my husband has forbidden me to tell you exactly how old I am, but I could tell you how old Marge Peterson is. You know we graduated in the same class, darling. You can't forbid me for that. But I won't. You can guess. Anyway, the point is, these are divinely appointed rhythms in nature, divinely appointed cycles. And after all, as Christians, the Bible tells me that the path of the just is as a shining light that shines more and more into the perfect day. And I would hope and pray that God will enable me to approach death as peacefully, as gracefully, as gladly as the oak tree, or the rock maple, or the dandelion, relinquishing step by step whatever it is in God's plan for me to relinquish next. And one thing after another happens. We gradually relinquish our powers. I look at my mother now, she's 83 years old, and it's very sad to me, in a way, to see her losing her memory. And to see her losing the tremendous energy she had. I've never known anybody that was more energetic. She's still very slim. She still drives her own car. She still lives in her own apartment, does her own cooking. And she comes over to our house, but every once in a while she'll say, "How did I get here? Which route did I come by?" And Lars and I tell her, well, such and such. And then she'll say, "Well, how do I get home?" And we'll say, "Well, just the same way you got here." "Well, how did I come?" And we just don't know when we're going to get a call from the police saying we've got an old lady down here that doesn't know where she is. She still seems to be an excellent driver. Her reflexes are so automatic. She's been driving, let me see, how many years? Something like 65, no, not 65 years. She wasn't 8 years old, no. About 65 years. She was one of the very first woman drivers in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And it would make me very sad to see that if I didn't realize that she is a Christian, she's headed where she wants to go, and this is part of the process of being human, and it is appointed unto men once to die. And so we have to learn to give, to relinquish, to open our hands. We give up our children. We give up control over them. We give up one thing after another, gradually. We talked about maturity being the measure of our self-giving. And the more mature we become, the more gracefully we should be able to give ourselves. Sexual maturity simply means the ability to reproduce. Spiritual maturity means the same thing. The ability to reproduce life in somebody else. And until we learn to give ourselves, we cannot possibly produce life in anybody else. And God saw to it that a human being does not become sexually mature until he is capable of thinking about somebody besides himself. And we all see in the little child, a totally egocentric human being. It's me, 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 what I want, and nobody else matters. And the job of a mother is to try to civilize that child and teach him to think about somebody else than himself, to say please and thank you for a start, and then to begin to be more and more unselfish. And if I may be forgiven for mentioning my little grandson again, when he was visiting us this summer in Massachusetts, he and I were walking down the street, and I said, "Walter, tell me what you want more than anything else in the world. And I expected him to say a diesel tractor or something like that. He's absolutely fanatical about cars and trucks and tractors and things like that, and particularly heavy equipment. He said to me once, he said, Elizabeth may play with my cars, but she may not play with my equipment. But when I said, what do you want more than anything else in the world, he thought for a minute. He kept walking. He finally looked up at me and said, Granny, what I want more than anything in the world is to be a good brother. Now, can you imagine a five-year-old? I say that God has his hand on that little boy. And that's maturity, isn't it? I mean, that is an amazing degree of maturity. One of the things that I pray for him is that he will grow in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. That's what Jesus did. And if children are intolerable and absolutely insufferable in church, in the supermarket, when they go out to visit Aunt Nellie, to say nothing of in their own homes, very likely it's because those parents have neither prayed nor worked to see to it that that child grows in favor with God and man. Maturity is self-giving. There are many aspects that we might take under this heading, give and it shall be given, but for tonight I want to emphasize particularly servanthood. It's a question of mentality. We don't have people anymore that are prepared, who have the frame of mind that is willing to serve. And if it doesn't exist anywhere else, it ought to exist in the church. How many people do you know in your church whom you can turn to because you know that she'll do anything? Are you the kind of person of whom it can be said, well, ask her. She's a Christian. She'll do anything. You know, almost all of us have the attitude, well, that's not my job. That's not my thing. I'm not really into that. I'm not really into foot washing. A servant has a certain frame of mind. We desperately need servants. The world desperately needs servants. People who are available. First thing about a servant is that he has a master. He's not his own. And we know that that's true of us as Christians. You are not your own. You're bought with a price. The precious blood of Jesus. Paul said he was Christ's bond slave. Is the experience of salvation primarily an experience of receiving the solution to all my problems, or the meeting of all my needs, or happiness all the time, wonderful peace of mind, plink-a-plink-a-plink-a-plink, that kind of thing? I believe that the experience of salvation should be first and foremost an experience of mastery, the recognition that we are acted upon, called, chosen, responsible, summoned. We have a master. There's too much of the cheap gospel being preached today. If you come to Jesus, he'll pay all your debts, fix up all your marital problems, heal all your diseases, solve all your problems. I don't find that in my Bible. I certainly find a God who can pay your debts, heal your diseases, solve your marital problems and all your other problems. But he doesn't promise that. The promises are such things as, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. Not that he's going to give us a bridge over all troubled waters. When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. Through much tribulation, you must enter into the kingdom of heaven. The violent take it by force. There are some very stern words in Scripture about what salvation costs. Bonhoeffer, who had paid a tremendous price for his loyalty to Christ, spoke of cheap grace. And I see a dismaying amount of cheap grace being propagated, especially on television, where the gospel has to be carefully pared down in order to catch the popular imagination. We have a master. When I was a student in college, we had the custom of, when we received our yearbooks at the end of the year, going around and getting our friends to sign their names in them. And we particularly hoped that when we took it to the one particular man who had interested us most, that he might write something besides his name. Usually people would write some little comment or something. And so it was with great trepidation that I took my yearbook at Wheaton to Jim Elliott to sign his name in it. And, of course, I hoped desperately that he would put something touching in there. And this is what he put in. Jim Elliott, 2 Timothy 2:4. Well, I raced back to my room, grabbed my Bible, quickly thumbed through until I found this verse. A soldier on active service will not let himself be involved in civilian affairs. I'm not finished. He must be wholly at his commanding officer's disposal. Now, that told me what Jim Elliott was like. I had some students asking me yesterday how you can develop a friendship with a girl in order to find out whether or not she might be a prospective wife unless you've had some kind of an intimate relationship with her. Believe me, I had absolutely nothing that could even approach an intimate relationship with Jim Elliott at this point. But that spoke worlds to me. By observing Jim Elliott on Wheaton campus and seeing that he didn't waste time in dining hall lines, he was always memorizing scripture or Greek verbs, he was the kind of person who carried his Bible around with him and at odd moments would be seen sitting on the grass of the campus reading his Bible. I knew that he got up early. He was always one of the first people in the dining hall line. All of those things I ticked off in my mind. That's the kind of a man I'm looking for. And that's the kind of a man I'm praying for. I didn't have to have any intimacy whatsoever to know that he fulfilled several of the qualifications that I'd written in the back of my diary when I was 16 years old. Kind of a man that I was asking God to give me. He knew a master, and he was at his disposal. So he wasn't going to get involved in civilian affairs. In fact, he had determined when he started Wheaton that he was going to get 2 degrees, a BA, which is the Bachelor of Arts, a degree that Wheaton College was qualified to confer, but also an AUG that no college in the world is qualified to confer, and approved unto God. He got that out of Paul's epistle to Timothy. And he knew that if he was going to be approved unto God, he was going to have to give up some other things. And one of them was girls, at least for a while, in order to keep his mind on the things that he was there for. And although I found out that he was interested in me, very interested in me, he had held those emotions in check because he was at his master's disposal. I often talk on those three qualifications for discipleship that I mentioned earlier. If you want to be my disciple, you must give up your right to yourself and take up your cross and follow me. And this summer, I was speaking on the first qualification, giving up your right to yourself, and afterwards a man raised his hand, and as soon as he began to talk, I knew that he must be either a psychiatrist or a psychologist because of the terminology that he was using, the jargon. But he said, how can you tell a person who has a low self-image that they should give up their right to themselves? Well, I'm not sure what I gave him for an answer, but I had an opportunity several weeks after that to talk with a Christian psychiatrist friend of mine. Incidentally, he's an MD, as a psychiatrist has to be, but he has now given up psychiatry because he's a Christian and he says it's a pseudoscience. It doesn't really exist. In fact, he calls it a lot of garbage, and he's gone back to family practice. And so I asked him the question that this man had asked me. I said, what would you have said? And he just smiled and he said, I could have answered him in one word. Pride. That's the reason for a low self-image. Pride is the reason for a low self-image. And of course I wanted him to elaborate, and he did. He said, a person who has a low self-image thinks that he deserves more than he got. He's been dealt a poor hand of cards. And he's angry about it and resentful and goes around with a very false humility, assuming that everybody hates him, that nobody appreciates him, that if they really knew him as he knows himself, they would appreciate him, but etc., etc. I think we recognize the wisdom of that statement. Forget your self-image and remember that you have a master. Someone to whom we are responsible. The second thing about the servant mentality is that his constant attitude is, anything you say, I'm at your orders. They say this in Spanish all the time, a sus órdenes. It's a very polite way that ordinary people talk to each other. Is there anything I can do for you? We would say in English. But in Spanish, it's literally at your orders. And that's the attitude that a servant should have to his master. But how many of us have said to the Lord, give me some spiritual work to do. I want to find some way to serve you, Lord. And if he says, all right, I'm going to give you a spiritual job, we say yes. And if he says, I'm going to give you a physical job, we say no. Yes, Lord, I want to serve you as long as it's spiritual. As long as it's intellectual work. But don't ask me to scrub anybody's toilets. Don't ask me to wash anybody's feet. Forgetting that in order to do the Father's will, Jesus had to become physical. Think about that. Thou who wast rich beyond all telling, all for love's sake, becamest poor. He despised not the virgin's womb, as the Christmas carol says. He had to become physical. He who had lived in glory came out of the ivory palaces into a world of woe and become a baby, a helpless baby. Is there anything in the world more helpless than a human baby? When you see a lamb born, as Lars and I did this summer in New Zealand, we were there in the season of lambing, and if you'd look out in a field where there were hundreds of pregnant ewes, you were just likely to see them practically popping. I never saw anything like it. All over the place, there were brand new lambs, and we got there just about 30 seconds after one of them had been born, and this lamb was staggering to its feet. The shepherd was with us, the rancher, and he said, well, it's been about 30 seconds. We missed that one by 30 seconds, and here was this lamb already staggering onto its feet. And the mother busily cleaning it up. And you think of the marvelous way in which God has provided for the survival of animals. You see those pictures on TV of the wild animals in Africa, and the water buck is born and instantly has to get up on its legs because it won't be able to keep up with the herd otherwise. And a human baby is totally helpless and stays that way for months. Years. Jesus became physical. A lady said to me not very long ago, I never asked God to make me a servant because I was afraid he might do it. She said, I really don't think I could do physical work. It's not my thing. A servant never dictates the terms on which he will serve. This is still under point two, if you're taking notes. Number one, he has a master. Number two, he says, anything you say, Lord. We are not in a position to choose. We are not in a bargaining position. We've already made the choice that he is our master. And so it's anything you say, Lord. And if you're tempted to be bitter and resentful about the lot that God has chosen for you, or the particular set of kids that you got, or the husband that you're stuck with, or that awful person at work that you have to work with. And you feel resentful, and as though you've been dealt a poor hand of cards. Just remember that God gives us gifts out of his magnificently varied grace for the sake of the body, in order that we may give something special, so that you may give something to me that I don't have, and so that I can give something to you that you don't have. How easy it is to look at certain gifts and think of them as being particularly well suited to the glory of God. But what nonsense. Because after all, God is the giver. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights. And he knows exactly what is needed. And so he gives you the gifts which are appropriate to the job that he wants you to do. And why does he give me the gift of writing? Is it for myself? I can assure you I've never written a line just for myself. It's for the sake of the body. Why does God give Cindy and Mary the gift of a beautiful voice? It's not so they can sing only in the shower. Maybe they sing in the shower, but that's not all it's for. It's for the sake of the body. I had an invitation a year or so ago from a certain group of women who asked me if I would come and speak to their convention, and I wrote back and accepted, and then I got a second letter asking me if I possessed a particular gift of the Spirit. And there was an apology in the last paragraph saying, I should have asked this question first. We need to know this because the rules of our organization are that we are not allowed to have speakers who do not possess this particular gift. And so I wrote back and said that among the gifts which God had given me was this gift didn't happen to be on the list. And so I would have to decline their invitation. If they wanted to discuss the matter with me, of course I would have said that it seems to me reasonable to expect that God will give us the gifts which are appropriate to the job he wants us to do. And if there is some other job that God wants to give me, then I expect that he will give me another gift, whatever is necessary at the time. But for the present, I receive with thanksgiving the gifts that God has given me, and then I'm supposed to give. I offer them back to him for the sake of the body. I offer them to anybody else for whom they may be useful. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Third thing is that the servant lives for the master. 2 Corinthians 5, verses 14 to 17. For the love of Christ leaves us no choice. When once we have reached the conclusion that one man died for all, and therefore all mankind has died, his purpose in dying for all was that men, while still in life, should cease to live for themselves and should live for him who for their sake died and was raised to life. With us, therefore, worldly standards have ceased to count in our estimate of any man, even if once they counted in our understanding of Christ. They do so now no longer. When anyone is united to Christ, there is a new world. The old order has gone, and a new order has already begun. And the footnote in my Bible for that new world says, a new act of creation. When anyone is united to Christ, there is a new act of creation. I love that. God is creating something new in me because I am in Christ. And he is the creator forever, isn't he? And with God there is no chronology. He is doing everything from before the foundation of the world, and he will be doing everything through all eternity. And so his creative act, which we think of as 6 days at the beginning of creation, is going on all the time in us, every sunset is an act of creation. Every birth is an act of creation. Every leaf, every bud. And in us, there is a new act of creation going on. So when I live for my master, I can count on the fact that there is creative, redemptive power at work in me. It's not mine. There's no question whatsoever of my being qualified in myself to do the jobs that God has asked me to do. The power does not come from me, but from God, that the excellency of the power might be of God and not of us, says Paul. We hear people talking about doing their own thing, being spontaneous, creative, original. And when I taught a course in the seminary called Christian Expression, which was not a writing class but did involve some writing, it was an attempt to get students to give attention to the form in which the message of the gospel was being presented. You can't deliver the milk without the carton. And as Christians, we are embodying the message of Christ all the time in our speech, in our writing, and in our behavior. And these were things that college students had never thought about. Seminary students were very resentful when the idea was even presented to them because they had grown up in the blue jeans generation where they were told that clothes don't mean anything, that courtesies are all a bunch of empty conventions, that traditions are meaningless, and the sooner we get rid of everything like that, the happier we're going to be. And so I had to start back from square one. And when I talked about writing to them, I said, please, please, please don't ever let me hear that word creativity. We are not creators. All we do is observe what's already been created and then give it some kind of form which will make it make sense to somebody else. And that's what witnessing is, isn't it? I don't come to you with my message. I'm just the messenger. Somebody else gave me the message to deliver. All I do is witness to something I've seen, something that's been given to me. And so I'm not a creator in that. I give the thing some kind of form which will enable you to get hold of it. When I look at a painting, for example, by Van Gogh, a beautiful Van Gogh sunflower, I'm enabled to see a sunflower through the eyes of Van Gogh as I could never have seen it by myself. I'm told that one of the French Impressionist painters who did a beautiful picture of a bridge in the mist was challenged by somebody who lived near that bridge. He said, I've seen that bridge in every light, every season, for 40 years, and I've never seen it look like that. And he was rather upset that the painter had given it this particular form. It doesn't look like that, he said. I've never seen it look like that. And the painter said to him, don't you wish you had? And what we see, we are to give to somebody else. But we are not to be original. If we aim at originality, our writing, our music, our painting is going to be very bad. I can't imagine any worse writing than that done by students who are trying to, quote, write and trying to be original and trying to be creative. I said, never aim at creativity. Aim at authenticity. Now, what is authenticity? I look at the life of Jesus. He lived for his Father. A servant lives for his master. And what did Jesus say? Not my will, not my words, not my work, not my life. We are imitators. We are followers. We are reflectors. We bear a fragrance that is not our own. We reflect an image of glory that we see in the face of Jesus Christ. I'm to live for my master. And so, like him, my watchword is not my will, not my words, not my work, not my life. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. It is a new order, a whole new act of creation. What would happen in your office, in your kitchen, in your schoolroom, in your church, if you really lived this way? Absolutely at the disposal of a master, prepared to do anything, not dictating the terms, and constantly remembering those rules that Jesus had. In New Zealand, Lars and I learned a beautiful song. I imagine maybe some of you have heard it, but I had never heard it before. Brother, let me be your servant. Let me be as Christ to you. Pray that I may have the grace to let you be my servant too. I will hold the Christ light for you in the nighttime of your fear. I will hold my hand out to you. Speak the words you long to hear. The world is desperate for that kind of a servant heart. And when somebody is prepared to be your servant, are you too proud to be served? Pray that I might have the grace to let you be my servant too. This may sound like a ridiculous idea, but I think of all the programs that we have in our church, all the things that people do and get called do-gooders for, and the things that people pat themselves on the back because they think of them as service. And this quirky idea occurred to me. When those people go to the nursing homes, what would happen if they took along a basin and a towel and washed the feet of those old people? How many people do you think you could find in the church that would get all keyed up about going with that crowd? And yet, is there any one of us here who has ever had her feet washed by somebody else who wouldn't say that it's one of the most delightful treatments you could ever give anybody else? I've had my feet washed and massaged. I remember when I was in the jungle, Marge Saint and I were traveling. One time she came down with me to visit the Alcas, and we had a 3-day trip by trail and canoe. And at one point along the way, we washed each other's feet and massaged them. And it was heaven. You know, it's just wonderful. But there's nothing wrong with my feet. And I think of poor old people who can't reach down to do their own feet. They can't do the toenails. They can't get the bunions off. I don't know how good the care is in most of these nursing homes, but just a suggestion. What if we took literally? And some of us would say, well, I don't think I could do that. But I'd like to remind you that it is always possible to do the will of God. It is always possible to do the will of God. If He has asked you to do it, He will enable you to do it. It's really quite silly to say to somebody else, oh, I could never do that. The point is, they couldn't either if God didn't ask them to, very probably. And if God is asking you to do that, you can do it, because God will enable you to. Give and it shall be given unto you. There is a principle beautifully articulated in Isaiah 58, verse 10. I don't know any greater therapy for loneliness and depression. Isaiah 58, verse 10. If you feed the hungry from your own plenty and satisfy the needs of the wretched, then your light will rise like dawn out of darkness, and your dusk be like noonday. Verse 11, the Lord will be your guide continually and will satisfy your needs in the shimmering heat. He will give you strength of limb. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. A young mother taught me a very profound lesson. She was a young Australian woman who had a little boy born with a serious congenital heart anomaly. And the doctors told her that the chances of his living until he was 4 years old were not very great, but they could not operate until he was 4. And so she lived with the constant knowledge that at any moment she might find that little boy dead in his crib or then his playpen. He must have had 13 or 14 operations. And she said to me, she said, I realized, Elizabeth, that I could make a career out of my little boy's illness. That I could feel so sorry for myself and be so wrapped up in him. And this terrible fear that I was going to find him dead, that I would be of no use to anybody else. And she said, I prayed that the Lord would free me to serve other people. And Jill came back to visit me when my husband had cancer. And by that time, she told me the story of how she had taken her little boy with her to visit a friend. And when she got to the house, he was asleep. And so she left him in the car, went in, had her visit, came out, and he was dead. And she came to talk to me because she knew that my husband was dying. And I thanked her for that lesson that she had taught me because I said, you know, I was tempted to do exactly the same thing, to make a career, brief as it might have been, out of my husband's illness. And I was feeling so sorry for myself in having to lose another husband that I was of absolutely no use to anybody else. And then I remembered Jill's lesson. And so I began to pray, Lord, release me from my own self-pity and my own vicarious sufferings in order to serve other people. Give me strength to give away. And these words express so beautifully that principle. If you give, it will be given to you. If you are absolutely down in the bottom of the barrel, God is telling you, you go out and feed the hungry from your own plenty. You've got something, something in the house. And satisfy the needs of the wretched, then your light will rise like dawn out of darkness. Your dusk will be like noonday. The Lord will be your guide continually and will satisfy your needs in the shimmering heat. He will give you strength of limb. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. I was listening to a lady the other day complain about some children, her grandchildren, as a matter of fact. And they didn't do this, and they didn't do that, and they did a lot of things that she didn't like, and she was very upset about them. And they never came to see her. And I said to her, have you ever thought of something that you could do for them? It's really difficult for me to imagine a grandmother not being able to think of anything that she could do for her grandchildren, but this particular grandmother didn't seem to be able to think of a thing. Everything about them was just irritating and upsetting to her. And she said, no, I can't think of anything. Can you? And I said, well, why don't you ask the Lord? I think he could give you some ideas. But I feel so strongly that this principle works. It illustrates what Jesus was talking about when he said, give and it shall be given unto you, pressed down and running over, full measure, shaken together. A servant has a master. He says, anything you say, Lord. He lives for the master. And he gives in order that it shall be given to him, along the lines of Isaiah 58:10. Would you like to be like a watered garden? Would you like to be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, whose fruit will not fail? Would you like to be mature enough to reproduce spiritual life in other people? May God make us true servants, and may he give us the grace to let others be our servants too. God bless you.